Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So tonight is our Dhamma evening. Some reflections are usually offered on Saturday night. And as usual, we have a little, almost every Saturday, we have a language problem here. So this morning, I guess you weren't asked, and I was informed that everybody seems to understand at least, 75% of good English. So that's good enough, because I don't think what I will offer will be too complicated to understand. I hope not. And we'll be in the context of some aspects of the teaching. And tonight I thought to reflect a little bit around the theme of awakening. The other day when Akso and I were walking in the mountains on our weekly Wandertag, we were musing a bit and even a bit puzzled by the fact that in certain spiritual quarters, the not only the word awakening, but also the claim of awakening seemed to be very widespread. People seemed to just toss it about and speak about that they've just had, that they just awakened or had an awakening. And of course, unless they really go into great detail about what they actually mean by awakening, one can't be absolutely sure what actually they're referring to. But still, and this, the context of that is actually usually communities or teachers who have present non-dual teachings or teachings connected with the Advaita Vedanta tradition. And as you probably know, in Buddhism, one is a little more careful and cautious about using the word awakening, especially as a claim for oneself. There are certain reasons for that, especially for monastics. There are certain regulations which allow us or don't allow us to be too outspoken about it, only amongst inner circles, so to speak. But let alone that, still the theme is a very interesting one. We all probably can relate to the fact that I would maybe reckon that everyone had what we'd call a glimpse of awakening or an inside experience or something, when something we had really been struggling with, we were really maybe previously confused about, uncertain about, suddenly dropped away. It could be happening through a former meditation, when our mind gets really nice and centered and calm, and we kind of getting in a wonderful mode of the right application of effort, then insights, glimpses of awakening can happen. And of course, that is very valuable and not to be dismissed. But usually, they're called glimpses of insight, glimpses of awakening. It's not a kind of, in a way, evolutionary step in our consciousness. So an evolutionary step, in that sense, would be something you couldn't revert, you couldn't turn it back, just like the evolution of the species. We can't turn the wheel back. We can't go back to the single cellular creatures. Now we have evolved into, human beings have evolved into very complex creatures, and still that process is ongoing on that level, on the material level. And similarly, I think when we're talking in the Buddhist context about awakening, or about one of the stages of awakening, we're talking about something which you can't really fall back from. Once you realize that, then this is it. And maybe you continue to mature to the next step and the next step and the next step. And in our tradition, the Theravada tradition, we have a very nice and convenient overview of four steps of awakening, they call it. It's the so-called stream enterer is the first level of awakening. Then you have the so-called once returner, then the no returner, and eventually then the fully awakened, completely awakened being, the Arahant, which is, of course, admittedly a very high ideal. And most people, I think, feel very shy, or even don't think that they have it what it takes to achieve that or to realize that in this very life. Even though a lot of teachers actually point to that and encourage us, don't do that. Don't put your light under the, what does that say in English? No, it doesn't, under the shuffle. Don't put your light there where it can't be seen. Maybe that's the way of putting it in English. And especially also don't speculate about it, because speculation really doesn't really help at all very much. So that one, what are we left with? I find it personally a very interesting area to reflect about. This is the first level of awakening, what we call stream entry, because it seems to be that there's the aspects connected with the stream entry or something we can maybe get the most easy way a relationship with, not just on a level of speculation and thinking about it or wanting or longing to be like that, but in our actual experience as, ordinary human beings, ordinary practitioners of the Dhamma. And some of you have probably heard this, the three aspects which one realizes, recognizes when this stream entry is realized, is that we are beyond skeptical doubts. We're not tossing about skeptical thoughts back and forth, to and fro, but that is laid aside. It's seen through the tendency that we get caught up in our cognitive mind entirely and just trying to figure things out via the mind, via the intellect. It leads us nowhere. It leads just to more and more doubt and even confusion. So that is laid aside, is seen through. And then the second aspect is the what's sometimes called the attachment to rites and rituals, but also it could be called the attachment to social conventions and to an unrealistic investment into sila and ethics. Because it's actually called sila bhatta paramasa, means an unrealistic investment. Sometimes you have people who keep precepts, rules, and regulations in a very rigid way, even to the extent that expect just by doing that, if I follow all the rules correctly, if I'm a good boy and a good girl, all the time, then this will lead to purification of mind. And this is not so, because we are warned of a wrong grasp of sila and ethics. And of course, to be understood, it's not dismissing of ethics. Of course, that's definitely not what it's saying. But the wrong grasp, the attachment to the use of sila, of ethics. And then if you reflect a little bit broader about it, it's also any kind of social conventions which is regulated by rules and regulations and so forth. And if we attach to it, if we invest with it, with an egoic mind and a narrow mind, a rigid mind, then that leads us to suffering and discontent. One of the, for me personally, most interesting aspect of this reflecting on this level of awakening is the first one. It's called Sakyaditi, and that's called sometimes simply translated as personality view or wrong personality view. But to really unravel that a little bit, the word Sakya actually means groups, simply means groups or groups of being. And the groups of being, again, in our Theravada tradition, they're very neatly put together as what is called the khandhas, the five khandhas, the groups of our being, of our experience, are the body. We have physical experience. We have feelings, feeling experience. We have perceptions and memories. We have mental processes, thoughts, willful processes, intentions, and so forth. And then we have all the stuff which comes in and is processed through the senses, the five senses, consciousness in connection with that. And those are the groups. It's very kind of neatly put, I find, in our tradition, because it gives us a nice and good grip on our personal experience. And then the other part of it, the dikkhi, when it's usually mentioned like that, we have, of course, in the Eightfold Path, I think most of you have heard this before too, the Samma Ditti, which means right view. Very often when ditti is just used without the Samma, it means actually wrong view or a wrong grasp. So if we retranslate this, it's a wrong grasp of these groups of being, wrong grasp of our relationship to ourselves, to our body, and to all the mental experience of feelings, of thoughts, and also, of course, how we relate to the aspects which affect our senses. And this is usually, as the teachings say, where we tend to identify. We tend to identify either with one of them or with all of them, and also invest a lot of emotional energy. In fact, that's what identifying is, isn't it? You invest a lot of energy in it. And identifying is also, of course, another way of putting it. We are assuming a sense of self, some kind of solid identity, independent entity also sometimes, as it's put. And this is our dilemma. Before we awaken, we are completely absorbed by our experience. Whatever it is, the whole lot, in quick succession, of course. And maybe that's why it's so difficult to see through, because things do happen in such quick succession, our thoughts and feelings and emotions and so forth, just one thing after another. Then of course, the commentary and sub-commentary, the value judgment, the criticisms, it should be like this or it shouldn't be like that. All that comes into it and tends to make things very, very complicated. So how can we get behind this, of course, is always a question. I personally find it helpful to get behind it, to always at least try, make an effort to connect with what I'm experiencing right now in any situation, really, be it on the cushion when I'm meditating, or be it in a social situation when I'm surrounded by people, be it when I'm traveling in the train, be it in this situation. I can always connect with the immediacy of my experience and see if there are any tendency to either reject or to grasp, to hold on. And this is very, you know, the kind of, yeah, definitely black and white scheme, you know, resisting and grasping. But you could very simply say this is the activity of self, of this assumed self-entity, consists of that, you know, of resisting and grasping. Resisting that what we feel uncomfortable with, what we don't like, what we feel irritated about, and we resist that. And then, of course, when we experience a wonderful experience, something really nice and agreeable, we like to prolong it, we like to hold on to it, keep it there, put it into a preservative jar, with a tight lid, so it stays there forever, preserved in its initial state. And all of us, of course, have made the experience that this is a hopeless enterprise, trying to preserve or trying to hold on to something, a good, wonderful experience, be it on a more coarser level, a sensual experience, a wonderful sensual experience, or be it in the more refined realms of our reality, in the realm of the mind, when our mind becomes very calm and even blissful and very much aloof of the normal humdrum of, you know, the core sensual realm. But even then, the tendencies of grasping, of course, come into play. So it's not such an easy issue, is it? It might sound like that, but it encompasses the whole spectrum of our experience, from the most coarse to the most refined. Everything is in it. As meditators, Buddhist meditators, or maybe meditators of all kind, we can also get sometimes a little bit obsessive about it. I think back of my early life, early monastic life, or my first steps in meditation. I used to have not only a lot of energy, but a lot of willfulness. Of course, one is inspired, one has heard wonderful teachings. I was lucky to also meet some good teachers quite early on. And so then, of course, you want to put yourself to the task and realize what these people have been talking about. And what, of course, also then all the other things you come across, the scriptures, the books have been recommended to also point to. And I've noticed myself a little bit of some obsessiveness and rigidity in the way I would approach this particular subject. And of course, initially, I wasn't really aware of it. I thought just you have to apply a lot of effort to put in all what you've got, not just 100% of the time, but at least 120%, even 150%. Of course, that's not how I was thinking about it. I thought, I'll just do my best. But in hindsight, it felt a bit like, you know, overuse of will, overexertion. And then, of course, what is the result of that? The mind doesn't become more open and spacious and relaxed. You don't connect so easily with stillness. You become neither aware of your own inner processes in a very kind of, you know, precise way. Neither do you become aware of the processes around you, you know, how other people relate to you and how I relate to other people. So, and I began to wonder. Fortunately, also, I had compassionate people who made me aware of that, pointed that out to me so that I could look at that. First of all, I didn't believe them. I thought they would try to find fault with me, but in reflecting in my quiet little room, At least I had the receptivity and the openness to give it the benefit of the doubt. Huh? Well, if that person has a perception of myself of being of the kind of rigid type, maybe there's some truth to it. Maybe not, I'm not totally overall rigid type, but maybe there's some truth to it. And after pondering that, I do admit, yes, maybe there's something to modify in the way I apply myself, I put myself to the task. Does the way I relate to myself, not only again on the cushion, but in daily life, does it lead to, you know, more receptivity, more openness, more clarity also, and maybe also informed by wholesome emotional qualities like an increase in compassionate or empathic connection, kindness. You know? Those are all very good indicators that to look out for, that we are on the track, so to speak. But then another compulsion can, of course, creep in, which constantly trying to monitor oneself, you know, how far have I got, you know, and what is the level of awakening I've reached now, and, you know, how, you know, and the, of course, the aspects belonging to Shuddhism, the joke people like to make about, instead of Buddhism, is practicing Shuddhism. I should be more compassionate. I should be more, having more metta, more kindness. I should be more concentrated. I should be more wise, etc., etc. I've had a fair share of that too, for years, without noticing that this was actually happening. I was practicing actually Shuddhism. I should be improving myself. It's a tricky one, because obviously, there's a task. We are working on our own inner evolution, you could say. We do try to improve. We do try to develop wholesome qualities and try to see the unwholesome one, not strengthen them, not increase them. But if one's not careful, one can get caught there. Huh? And rather than really developing the wholesome and letting go of the unwholesome, we tie ourselves in knots. Huh? And we're practicing Shuddhism. There's always that super ego in the back. We say, I should do more maybe, or I should be more diligent, I should be more concentrated, I should be more mindful, I should be this or I should be that. That's a big obstacle for, I think, probably all spiritual practitioners, not just Buddhist practitioners. Because admittedly, we are dealing with very high ideals. I would say these are the highest ideals humanity can come up with. What higher ideal could you mention than to fully awaken or at least to be in the process of awakening, in the process of letting go of everything which oppresses us, which brings us suffering, which brings us even just the slightest sense of pressure in our hearts and ill at easeness in our hearts. I can't think of anything. And so that's why this process, of course, is still ongoing, still investigating, still trying to find out where, you know, our tendencies maybe of rigidity, of narrow-mindedness, of super-ego control, and so on, where is it and how is it coming in? There's an interesting little story I read the other day from my teacher, from Ajahn Sumedho, when he was in Thailand, and he was a very young monk. He had just about learned to understand the language. He was practicing very hard. He was suffering from similar things I just talked about. He was very diligent, super diligent, practice. In Thailand, of course, that's very much encouraged. Patipat, patipat, patipat. Talk like that. You know, patipat monks. Practice monks, you should practice. And so he tried to do that. And then he noticed when he lived in the community he lived, he got very critical towards the monks who didn't seem to be up to scratch on standards of his patipat, patipat, patipat. So he was internally criticizing them and finding fault with them. So, these slack monks, you know, they're not really serious about Buddhist practice, Dhamma practice. They're just kind of hanging in there and having a good time. And then after a while, I think he did understand the language a little bit better. And then in Buddhist monasteries and forest monasteries in Thailand, they have something which is called the dying shed. It's not where you die, where you fall over and die, but where you dye your robes with dye, with rope color made from the jackfruit tree. And, you know, you chip little bits of wood from the jackfruit tree into small chips. You kind of stew it up in a big cauldron, a big pot. It takes a long time, and then you get this very, very nice dark brown broth. Then you sieve it out so that the chips end up in a big sieve, and then you have the pure broth, and that's where you put your robes in. You dye them, and you also wash them in there. That's the dying shed. And in the dying shed, there's usually a very steamy, hot affair, and sometimes goes on for hours, even days. When you dye completely new robes, it can take a couple of days. And usually always a few monks hang out there. And he noticed that when monks are in there, their speech gets very loose. You know, they joke with each other and they kind of fool around a bit. And in some monasteries, they even smoke cigarettes. And so he observed that. And when he heard what these monks were talking about, he thought, this is absolutely outrageous. They're talking about things the Buddha strictly recommended monks shouldn't talk about, frivolous stuff, you know, about women and wars and politics and sports and all sorts of things. And so he got his critical faculties got really activated, and he thought, oh, these monks are terrible. And then one day he actually decided to confront one of them. And he said to them, you know, what are you doing here? This is, you think this is right? This is wholesome speech, right speech, huh? And the monk said, you know, you have to understand that the dying shed has a function in the forest monastery. It's like a psychological liberation area where you can be a little bit more free. You can even fool around a little bit and talk about things normally you wouldn't talk about. And, you know, then kind of it eases the pressure a little bit of this, of course, very, you know, often very disciplined lifestyle. And then Ajahn Sumedho thought to himself, he took this in, and then he looked, of course, at his own way to relate to this whole situation and also how his own practice was going, probably. And he thought to himself, well, maybe I should relax a little bit more and not be so critical also towards these monks, because actually they're all, you know, pretty good people and quite earnest in their practice. It's just they're using that situation to leave off steam a little bit. And every monastery seems to have places also in the West. You know, we have had woodsheds, which used to be places where you could do that, or other places where people could just informally meet and just rant a little bit about things which they normally wouldn't dare to rant about, because they would, of course, catch themselves and think, well, this is not beautiful speech. This is not right speech. And you see, I'm not condoning that. I'm not condoning the fact one should, you know, do this every day or so. But it seems to be that if one always tries to be super perfect, super samma, huh? Right, trying to do everything right and perfect, and having this understanding, I should be perfect all the time, then you're building up so much pressure in yourself, and so much inner resistance comes, which can either be, of course, directed towards yourself. You can take the conclusion, I don't have it what it takes, I'm not good enough, I'm not a good monk. I've met lots of monks who've been like that. I don't really have it. Look at this one over there. He's so perfect. He does everything super duper. Or you project it out. You find fault. You think, oh, look at him. Oh, whatever. He's really not very serious. He's not like me. You know, it's a horrible, horrible case. And so I think that probably was a very important insight for Ajahn Sumedho, huh? The idea to relax a little bit. And certainly relaxed he has, what I observed over the years, that certainly became a reality for him. And so how, you know, of course this is an example from Thailand, from a forest monastery in Thailand, and I think, even though maybe that sounds a little bit kind of far away and foreign for you, well, maybe you can transfer it to your environment, to your life, your situation, in your work, in your home situation, where you know you notice these mechanisms, right, of projecting negativity out, expecting other people either to be perfect or trying to be have a super high standard for yourself, which you can never reach. You know, the measuring stick is just far too high. And of course, what is sometimes seems to, we seem to end up with a paradox. Well, how do I deal with this? You know, how do I have a healthy sense of a healthy measuring stick, you could say, or realistic measuring stick? And, you know, without either shooting too high, which is constantly, you constantly feel like a failure, or relaxing too much, where you just, you know, give it all together and you think, you know, just being aware in the moment is all you need to do. Right, if you can be completely aware in the moment all the time, 100%, good on you, wonderful. But if you notice that it's not like that 100% all the time, then the obvious indication is that there's some work to do, there's a task to do, there's some still some more looking to do, investigation to do. We have to make our hearts, our minds, the object for our investigation. And not, when I say objects, of course, not in a critical way, supercritical way, hypercritical way, which again comes from the sense of self. This again is Sakaya Ditti behind it. And when the critical faculty towards ourself sets in, we can always be 100% sure this is the Sakaya Ditti operating full speed, full strength. And the objects, and of course we, I think very important is also to acknowledge if we become too fixated on the objects of our mind, the objects of our experience, the feelings and emotions we have, the physical aspects, the thought patterns, the habits and so forth. That tends to limit us. And then we get kind of fixated on things, on objects, on solid things. It's good, of course, to familiarize oneself what the objects in our minds are, particularly the regular visitors and what regular comes through. And the regular ones, of course, are the habits which we've acquired over a lifetime, maybe even going back beyond that. But then there's another aspect, which is that all this happens within, you know, the space of mindfulness, of awareness, or it can happen within the space of mindfulness and awareness. If we remember it, that's actually the original meaning of sati, of mindfulness, sarati. It means to remember. So we need to remember that we have this faculty of awareness. And I don't know about you, but I have to admit and let you know that I do forget. I have to constantly remind myself that the objects, the visitors in my mind, in my heart, they're really just that, they're visiting. They're happening within something. They are not, it's not me, it's not mine, it's not who I am. They're just coming through. And what is it what receives that? What sees that? What is aware of that? Which is coming through this, through our citta, as it says, our minds. What is that? And that I can't really put my finger on. This is not a thing, isn't it? It's not that's not an object of our mind, which is aware of that. Objects can be seen. Objects can be identified. Objects can be even analyzed if you want to. But what is it what sees it, what receives it, and is not taken in by the object character of our experience? And that's something I really like to leave open. It's just as an open question. What is it? Or maybe also to ask, how does it function? Or how can I connect with it? How can I remain being connected with it? These kind of questions are very skillful, because they don't lead us into doubt. They just lead us into an inquiry. Huh? How do I just a little bit withdraw from the tendency to get sucked in by the objects of our experience and instead go the other way, to disidentify, you could say, but not as an act of will, because that creates a counter reaction. If I do it as an act of will, because I understand, okay, the objects of our mind is not who I am, so I pull myself back with all might, then I just create a counter reaction. I end up in resisting and in aversion or in avoidance even. So when we're pointing towards the quality of awareness or mindfulness, then is something which is not tangible. We can't grasp it. Our conceptual mind cannot identify it. We can find maybe even more words for it. We can even describe it with other terms than awareness and mindfulness if you want to. I don't personally think it's necessary, because we all, I think, can quite immediately notice if we only care to look, if we disentangle ourselves from the tendency to always get identified with the objects of our experience, of these, the wrong, as I said initially, the sakaya ditti, the wrong view of our personal, the wrong view, take it literally, the wrong way of looking on our body, on our feelings, on our emotions, mental formations, and experience and sense consciousness. And that's the learning, and that is the learning we could do if we care to proceed with this project of awakening. So I'd like to just offer this for your pondering for tonight.